even as I was claiming I had created this invisibility tech before it was ever published to the public, I had physicists saying he's lying. That's impossible. He's got no post-secondary schooling. You can't invent an invisibility material. And we see in the Ukraine war now, it's become drone warfare on both sides. And so they're using the same types of sensors, right? The visible, the near infrared, and the thermal to spot their targets. Well, how do you hide from those? With most types of camouflage, you can only hide from maybe two of them. The thermal is especially difficult.
Right.
And yet we can do that with this fairly inexpensive material. One of the best teams out there, they tested it against motion detectors and heat sensors. This is the first time we've ever been able to get past motion sensors and heat detectors.
Wait a minute. Did you just say with your invisibility cloak that you could like get past motion detectors? Welcome to the Wolf of Yonk Street podcast, everybody. My guest today is Guy Kramer. He's the president and CEO of Hyperstar B Corp. I learned while doing my research that your grandfather happens to be an inventor as well.
Yeah, my grandfather, Donald Lewis Hings, he self-taught himself in the areas of communications and audio, and he could do Morse code. And by the time he got to his late teens, he was already running around with something that was the equivalent of a university degree in understanding, although he'd never spent a day in post-secondary schooling. Wow. And so very outside of the box thinking, because he always said no one ever taught me what the boundaries of the box were. So he ended up to go on and invent the walkie-talkie just prior to World War II for Cominco, which is a mining company up in Trail, BC. And they had designed it for the bush pilots. And so the president of the company wanted to make sure that the geologists that were on the ground would be able to communicate back with the bush pilots or headquarters if possible, and thought this was impossible. And but he put it out there. My grandfather, within a couple of months, came up with the pack set, and you could drop it into water. It weighed about 15 pounds and it worked up to about 150 miles. And so the patent actually came out in 1939, and it came out the day that Canada declared war on Germany. And anything that gets invented during wartime, the government can actually claim ownership of. And this became a problem after the war for him. But Cominco loaned him to the Defense Department. He ended up running the civilian part of the Signal Corps. And he became so important to Canada's war effort that before D-Day, they actually dressed him up as a colonel and put him on the plane with the Minister of Defense. It was on a Lancaster. And when he landed, they just told him, don't say anything, and here's the protocols, right? But we're trying to hide the fact that you're actually in country. We don't want the Germans knowing that. And he was considered one of Canada's top scientists during World War II. So he actually worked with Dr. Egerton, who came up with the triggering device for the atomic bomb, and Dr. Hill from the UK, who brought radar over to the United States, along with the first jet engine. And so he was part of this very secretive group that worked out major problems that the Allies were having during the war. After the war, he had to fight Canada for the rights for the walkie-talkie, which he ended up winning. He took the king to court and won. He was the first person in Canada to do so. But he kind of blacklisted himself when he did that. And so when you take the country to court over something like that, they don't really want to give you an award or anything. So the British government ended up giving him a Member of British Empire Award, but Canada didn't give him the Order of Canada until 2001. So, and he really didn't want it, and he was getting too old to fight the children. And he didn't ever desire the recognition. He was all about curiosity and making the world a better place. And we were always fighting. I had friends in school that didn't believe that my grandfather invented the walkie-talkie because there was nothing out there that said he did, right? And so that recognition for the Order of Canada actually helped kind of propel him with the internet and everything else into that recognition that he deserved for that. Now, he had 56 other patents to his name, and they varied across a wide spectrum. Most of them were in communications, but he had a special golf club. He had a wind turbine. He had an oil finding device. He came up with the technology that they use for these bullet trains that work off magnetic propulsion. The electronic piano, he had a molded circuit board. So you name it, he was into everything. And wow. He was just very curious. And so when I graduated high school in 1985, he was looking for someone in the family to take on a lot of his knowledge base that he knew was going to disappear when he passed away. And his first choice was my cousin Morgan Burke, and who was working up at the Triumph Particle Nuclear Accelerator in UBC.
Yeah.
And he is a genius, right? He, my cousin, like, he could run circles around me. And he didn't want this assistant position with my grandfather. And neither did any of my other cousins. And I was looking at actually going to film school at down in USC. I'd finished BCIT cinematography class. I earned a first class mark for that. And that's the extent of my post-secondary schooling. And so I looked at going to USC or learning new things with my grandfather that no one else knew about. And so I decided to approach him. And I think I was maybe his 12th choice on the list of cousins out of 15, right? But he reluctantly brought me on. And within about, I'm guessing about 8 months, he started to recognize that maybe I had what he was looking for. And I started to challenge him on some of his concepts and ideas. And I was going down in a few years after this, I was going down to Fiji, New Zealand, and Australia on a trip with my father. And I challenged him on one of his ideas where we actually needed some readings from those areas. And so he said, okay, tell me where you think this change is going to happen on your trip before you go, and then go down there and prove it to me. So I did it, and I was within 50 kilometers of what I predicted. And so at that point, he realized, okay, he knows what he's talking about now. And he had me going down to the library in Burnaby, BC, and taking out textbooks from universities that he said, just kind of get a little bit of knowledge in all areas, because science works in all of them. The new discoveries aren't going to come just in one area like chemistry or physics or biology. The whole universe works together. So yeah. The new discoveries are going to be having a comprehension and understanding of some of those areas. And so I became a kind of a jack of all trades, right? Expert in none. And he was the same way. Right. But he had this insatiable appetite to just read anything he could. And I do the same thing. And I was doing it back then. It was just my makeup. Right. And whether that's genetic or learned, I don't know. Right. But there's probably a bit of both in there. Yeah. And so I used to take apart my toys as a kid to figure out how they worked. And sometimes I could put them back together again, and a few times I couldn't, meaning I wasn't going to go into being a mechanic of some sort. And yet a lot of what I do now is working in that area, because you're doing something new. There's no one to turn to sometimes to go, how would I do this and this? Yeah. And of course, with the secrecy that was involved in the invisibility cloak, we thought it was going to get classified. I couldn't turn to anyone else. Right. I had to figure it out myself. And so when you're pushed into a corner, quite often you can come up with solutions that maybe you otherwise wouldn't look at or comprehend in the first place. So I think it really pushed me to break through some of the barriers that I might not have been able to at that point in time.
Yeah.
my grandfather, he trained me until 1991, kicked me out of the nest, and he goes, I've taught you everything I can.
Yeah.
And I can't teach you anymore, right? So you need to take what I've taught you and apply it to whatever in the future. So he wasn't a part of HyperStealth, although the recent Province News article skewed it that way. And I kept trying to go, it's great that you talk about him and my background, but he didn't have anything to do with the company or the invisibility. So my grandfather was very good at inventing, not very good on the business side. Although he was successful, he never strived to be a multi-millionaire or a billionaire. But for even when I worked with him, it was of really little interest to him to actually promote any of the discoveries and inventions to the business side. And he was retired. They had enough and that's all he needed, right? And so I find as I'm running a business now as a CEO, I have a different hat to wear, right? My responsibility is to the 150 shareholders in the company. And so I can't do what my grandfather did. I have to make a business out of this.
Yeah, so it actually is funny because now I'm curious what the family cookout was like, because like everybody's an inventor. What was the family cookout like?
It, everything was very normal, right? And when I say normal, I thought every kid had a grandfather that invented a walkie-talkie, right? There was nothing to compare it to. And so only as I got older and started to talk to other friends and everything, I had one of my friend's dads used to say, oh, this is a guy says story, right? Like I'm just making it up. And I was never making anything up, but that's how he perceived it at the time. And even as I was claiming I had created this invisibility tech before it was ever published to the public, I had physicists saying he's lying. That's impossible. He's got no post-secondary schooling. You can't invent an invisibility material. It doesn't exist, right? And it's all a whole bunch of hogwash, right? So I dealt with this throughout my childhood, my teen years, my adult years, and only recently as these patents have been granted, and we have 11 granted now since 2022 for these different inventions. Have people actually started to take me seriously? Right. And for me, it was a cautionary tale that to be taken seriously, you either need to go to school to get those letters behind your name, or you need to have life experiences that people look at and go, okay, maybe he does know what he's talking about. And I should jump back a bit. In 1989, I was on Canada's top paintball team. And we had won the Canadian championships and we had placed third in the worlds that year. And so I wore a British camouflage that was very difficult to get because of the problems in Ireland. The British weren't allowing the pants to be sold out there, just the jacket. So if you're looking to be fully camouflaged in the same pattern, it was very difficult to come by. And someone had managed to find a pair of pants for me. So I was out there. I was the only one out there in British camouflage. Everyone else was wearing the American four-color camel that you see in the original Rambo movie. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't see me. My own teammates couldn't see me. And so that got me curious about camouflage. And those paintballs hurt when they hit. So the more you can do to not be seen to not get hit means you're not going to go through as much pain. So it's funny because my partner later on in 2004, Lieutenant Colonel Timothy O'Neill, he is the world expert on camouflage. He was a tank commander in the Vietnam War, and he had five tanks blown up with him inside, and in two of them, the crew all perished except for himself.
Wow.
And he said the same thing. He goes, when someone's shooting at you, you start to think about camouflage differently than you would under normal circumstances. And if it becomes about life and death, you better know what you're doing in this field. And so I started to look at camouflage patterns, I looked at these new digital patterns that were coming out, and I'm like, that looks like a kid with graph paper did that, right? And the Canadian government has spent a couple of years and many millions of dollars coming up with their CADPAT design, Canadian pattern. And later on, I found out it was actually researched very well. They can justify a lot of that expenditure. And to this day, their CAD pad actually still excels. But I had put out a web page that actually showed what I could do in 2 hours with a simple $100 graphics program. Mm. And the King of Jordan saw that web page and hired me to design their Royal Guard camouflage. So it was going to be about 200 uniforms. And I was like, whoa, hold on a second. I'm not the expert here, right? this is my hobby, right? And they said, no, we actually like what we see, right? We believe you've got something here, right? So, and then I started dealing with the cousin to the king. I actually never spoke directly to the king. I heard him in the background a number of times, but his cousin, he only had two cousins, right? Yeah. His cousin was one that dealt with me usually three times a day, every day except for Fridays, which is their holy day there. And this went on for 6 months. And through that procedure, I put myself on a kind of the same thing I'd done many times before, figure out what is the current understanding and find out what they think the next item is. And that turned out to be fractals. And a fractal, a very simple explanation of a fractal is if you look at the leaf of a fern, it's made up of these smaller leaves, and those smaller leaves look almost identical to the larger leaf other than scale. Right. That's what a fractal is.
Right.
And it's a repeating geometric shape found in nature, and some are very complex and some are very basic.
Right.
And so if you actually traced out a shoreline on a page and you didn't have any scale reference, like you couldn't see how big the waves were, and you drew a 1 mile shoreline or a 200 mile shoreline, you may not know the difference because it's a fractal. And so I had figured out how to bury these fractals into camouflage based off of what they said this next jump in camouflage was going to be. And that was when Lieutenant Colonel Timothy O'Neill approached me and he said, why are you coming into my territory? Right. So he had very knee-jerk reaction, understandable. And after a weekend of us going back and forth and sharing information, he goes, you've got the technology, right? These fractals. And he goes, don't tell me how you're doing it because the Americans won't want to work with you. You're a foreign national. You're a Canadian citizen. So for you to work with the Americans, you have to know something that no other American does. Mm. And he never did ask me ever. And he actually just passed away in November of last year, but also a brilliant mentor. So I had all these opportunities. I had a business mentor. I had my grandfather. I had this camouflage mentor. So he took me from relative obscurity to, guy, here's what we know. He's a permanent faculty member at West Point Military Academy.
Yeah.
So he taught on camouflage. He wrote books on scientific papers on camouflage.
Yeah.
And so he goes, together we could do better than separate. So we teamed up from that point on, and we worked on almost every project together except for one that we couldn't work on, the U.S. Army camouflage, because they put him on the Army side that was going to select, and it would have been a conflict of interest. So for almost 3 years, we didn't talk to each other.
Wow.
We didn't say a word to each other. Even when we went to a conference together, he came by, shook my hand, said hi, and walked away. And that's how it had to work, right? Because there could not be any potential conflict. And he said, they were so worried about it, they actually had me advise on the testing procedures, and then they basically never talked to me again after that.
Wow.
And they never took any of my advice on the testing procedures.
Wow.
They did subjective testing rather than objective testing, and that's not how you should test camouflage.
Yeah.
And so when I was working with the king, it became apparent to them that I'd come up with a fairly good design for their Royal Guard, and they wanted it for their Army Air Force. Mm. They wanted it for their police. They wanted it for their civil defense unit, which is their ambulance and firefighters, which is something common in the Middle East we don't see here.
Yeah.
Their border unit. So it ended up, their Navy, it ended up being this huge, a couple million uniforms that they had made. And so when I finished with that project in 2004, I thought, well, maybe there's other countries out there that want to do the same thing. Yeah. And so the United Arab Emirates started working with us through the king at that point, because he's very friendly with the United Arab Emirates.
Wow.
And then other countries started to reach out to us as all of a sudden Jordan released this camouflage that everyone's going, oh, wow, where did that come from? Oh, it came from this company in Canada, right? And so we ended up working with over 50 countries. Not all of them took our camouflage, but we made patterns for over 50 countries.
Yeah.
We've got about 7 million uniforms, military uniforms that have been issued. We've had some highs, we've had some lows through all of that. It paid the bills through this process. I designed the Optifade hunting camouflage for W.L. Gore and Associates. So they wanted us to design a camouflage that ungulate, so hooved animals like deer, couldn't see. And so I worked with Tim O'Neill, and I worked with an animal vision expert called Dr. Jay Nietzsche. And he provided information that allowed me to develop patterns that the animals couldn't see. Yeah. And there's videos of deer coming right up to the hunter. They can smell them, but they can't see them. Right? Which is very dangerous, because you're sitting there going, that thing has huge antlers. If it wanted to charge you, it could kill you, right? So I don't know why someone would put themselves in harm's way, but there has been evidence that what we did isn't just marketing. It actually defeats animal vision out there. And so then I've gone on to develop hunting patterns for Beretta, for Harkala, which is a big hunting company in Europe. And so we've got a couple of contracts that are still out there, but my focus in the last couple of years has been the patents and the invisibility. And that really, in my view as an expert in camouflage, should be what everyone is reaching for, not a static camouflage pattern. Because with any kind of camouflage and with training, you can make movement hard to detect, but it's not impossible to detect. And so movement will give you away. Even the best trained soldiers out there will be seen by their movement, even if their pattern completely blends in with the background. And so our invisibility material negates that movement.
And that's what, and that's actually what I'd like to understand a bit more. How is, what makes your invisibility cloak so special, so different, that it's able to defeat the conventional cloaking material?
Like most discoveries, this was an accident. So the light bending material is basically these 3D lenticular lenses. Right. So you can see the movement of the, and so children's books, movie posters use that technology. And so you can get these single-sided lenses. And if you were to look at the lens close up, it actually looks like that. Mm. And so you've got your lenticules there, and this faces, these ridges face the outside there. And so you can make a target invisible with that. But what it does is it stretches out the background. So it blurs everything in the horizontal, and yet you can still see horizontal items there. So if I'm wearing a big black belt and I've got tan pants and a tan shirt, you'll see this black streak where my belt is. Mm. So, and you can't patent something that's been out for close to 100 years out there, or even something that's been out for 10 years. So what I did was something very different. And by playing around with the lenses, what I found was that if I took those lenses, so if I took two sets of those lenses and actually offset them, so there, this would be parallel. Most people would think if you just make them parallel like that, you're gonna do what I'm doing, and that's not true. And the patent office has actually run into this difficulty in just about every country we've talked about. They assume this is what we're talking about, where they're parallel with each other. Mm-hmm. And when we say, no, they're not parallel, they're offset, then they look into other patents, scientific papers, and then they realize no one's ever done that before.
Right.
Right. To just put them in parallel, that's not a patentable item. Right. And so all of a sudden, when they realize that, all of a sudden we go from, we were only going to give you two claims to, no, we're going to give you 70 claims, 70. Right. And so that's that aspect is critical. So if I was to actually put them in parallel like that, you would actually see me through it and you would see the background, but the background would be mirror image. So the tree over here would actually be seen on this side, right, and everything on this side would be seen on that side, but my face would just be mirror image, and right, and actually it would flip if I got close enough to the lens,
right,
but you'd still see me through it. Now by actually putting it offset like that, where one ridge is close to the trough of the other,
yeah,
then you create this, you actually create two negative refractive images on either side. And what you get is the image does this, and then it crosses over, and it doesn't just cross over like this, it crosses over like this.
Right.
So everything in that middle section, regardless of whether my belt buckle is black or purple or orange, you don't see it. So it works much better than the blurring of the single-sided lens. And the farther back you go, the larger the object you can hide. And by putting these in parallel, right, we don't need to increase the thickness or anything. We could hide, theoretically, a building with the same material, the same thickness of material, just by putting them side by side and above and below each other. We don't need to actually change anything on the lenses themselves. It creates this massive piece of invisibility. So it's very difficult to comprehend how that works because it's never been seen before.
So there is something I'd like to understand there. So with at least the little I know about camouflage, just which is from movies, by the way, it's important that the camouflage sort of matches you to the background in such a way that you kind of, classic camouflage, right? You just blend into the background. But what this sounds like is just a sort of an illusion of light, right? That makes whatever's behind the lens just disappear. So, well, I mean, maybe I'm missing the point here. Wouldn't it be obvious that, you know, there's some sort of screen there if you just have like, okay, there's like a glass in the middle of like, because what I'm trying to get into is how that becomes something that we apply in the real world, in the military, where, you know, they're trying to basically, you know, let's say sneak through enemy territory without getting detected. You know, you can't just put something that, okay, there's nothing. Yeah, sure, you can't see anything behind it, but then it's completely out of place because it doesn't match the environment. So how does that work?
What you want with camouflage is something that blends into the background all the time, regardless of different lighting conditions throughout the day, different times of the season, nighttime. You want it to function in all of those. And static camouflage, the typical uniform that you would wear, doesn't do that. And even under night vision, so this has become a critical issue with militaries nowadays because so many militaries have access to very inexpensive night vision. How does it function under those conditions? So camouflage was usually only designed for visual mitigation, not for night vision mitigation. And so now there's a whole bunch more science that goes into those static patterns out there. But our light bending works in night vision. It works in the short wave infrared, which is the very expensive night vision that like SEAL Team 6 uses out there. So the reason they use that is as you go farther into that spectrum, the inks in camouflage don't function anymore. So that what you actually see through your viewfinder is the base color of that material, which is typically a white or an off-white. So the enemy glows to these SEAL Team 6 members out there. And those members, even if they're on the adversarial side, even if they're using standard night vision, can't see the Navy SEALs. And so that's an advantage that they have out there. But our material actually functions in that. So my concern when we were looking at putting this out there was this shouldn't be out there. This should be classified. That was my perspective all along. And the Canadian government looked at it and basically said, no, it's not classified. We don't see the same way you do. The Americans disagreed with them, but they also said, listen, this is not Hollywood, right? We don't intervene on foreign national decisions like this. We don't agree with it, but we don't interfere or intervene with them. So I actually tried to get the Americans to acquire it so that they could classify it, and was unsuccessful in that area as well. Again, it's very difficult when they're not dealing with an American company out there. If we were an American company, they would have classified it. And they have that ability to do so for any of their own citizens, right? Even if you don't want them to, they're going to do it if they feel there's a national security effort, but they can't do that to foreign nationals. So even right. though they believed it should have been, they couldn't interfere. And I went back to the Canadians 9 times with my Brigadier General friend, and we both said this needs to be classified, and they denied us every time. So what you want is something that not only works in the night vision, but also the thermal. So now all the U.S. ground forces are being issued with this new hybrid night vision and thermal sensor. So they're assuming that they're going to be able to see all the enemies all the time. Right. Well, that's not true if you got this material, because it blocks thermal. It doesn't bend thermal. It bends all the other parts of the spectrum, the ultraviolet, the visual, the near infrared, which is your standard night vision, the shortwave infrared, the expensive night vision, and it blocks thermal. So it essentially does the same thing. You can't see the target behind this. Right. And as long as the target's not touching it, it takes on the ambient temperature of everything around it. So it blends in with the background. So it's kind of the Swiss knife of camouflage, right? Because you only need one piece to work anywhere around the world. Well, I'm going to the Arctic. Okay, it'll work there. I'm going to the jungle. It'll work there. We're doing a night mission. It'll work there. Oh no, right. It might snow tonight. It'll still work, right? So it really is the pinnacle of camouflage. And Lieutenant Colonel O'Neill, he didn't play a part in the development. And it was actually a couple of years before he ended up seeing it in a military meeting. And he was blown away. He goes, well, there's no power source, right? Like, this is easy. How did you come up with this idea? And I said, well, my grandfather was all about hybrid solutions. He said, the universities are working on nanotechnology and this and that, and they're spending millions on it. Quite often the solution is a simple half step.
Yeah.
Right. And he goes, go around and look around and see what you've got in your lab. I don't have a lab. I almost did it with HyperStealth with all the stuff I'd collected over the years. But a lot of the times I would just go to the local hardware store and walk around the aisles and look for things that would kind of give me that flash of, oh, that'll work with that.
Yeah.
And we might be able to have this function there. And sometimes that's all you need, is just that, okay, I'm having a problem with reflection with these lenticular lenses. Well, putting up a bug screen in front of it, like you have on all the windows of your house, tends to take away a lot of that reflection, right? We actually put that into the patent, that could be a potential solution, right? Not just nano coatings that will remove that glare, but also this bug coating. So, it's a different way of kind of problem solving out there. And it all goes back to my life experience as a paintball player. Right. And then my experience with Lieutenant Colonel Timothy O'Neill, and then dealing with soldiers, I started to get to know Navy SEALs. I've got 3 Navy SEALs that advise for me. One of them is from SEAL Team 6. I've got, and they're all retired now. Three JTF2 soldiers. One was an assaulter. One was a supporter. One was a special supporter. So that's Canada's tier one team. And I can go to these people and ask the question, this or that, and they'll come back and they'll go, oh, no, you need to be looking at it this way. You need to be looking at it that way. Or here's the problem that we're having. We can't solve this problem. So again, I don't have military experience. I have paintball experience. That's different, right?
That's close enough.
Well, some people might say that, but really if you're not scared of those paintballs, you can do a lot that you wouldn't ever do under normal combat conditions, right?
Yeah.
And yet, if I had this invisibility shield in paintball, we would have won every game out there.
Yeah.
No one would have ever seen me, right? And so that's where we're hoping it's going to get to, is hiding the good guys and making it difficult for the bad guys to see them. And we see in the Ukraine war now, it's become drone warfare on both sides. And so they're using the same types of sensors, right? The visible, the near infrared, and the thermal to spot their targets. Well, how do you hide from those? With most types of camouflage, you can only hide from maybe two of them. It's very difficult to hide from all three. The thermal is especially.
Right.
And yet we can do that with this fairly inexpensive material. So we have the solutions. We just need the financial support to get it to the next level. So it's in prototype stage right now. All our finances are going into the patents. It's a very expensive process to get.
Yeah.
I mean, we filed in over 50 countries. So we don't have the money to actually get this to manufacturing stage. But we do have a group out there that is approaching us right now saying, we might be willing to do that for you, right? If it works as you are showing in the videos and we can prove it, then we can justify the expenditure to get you to that stage. So we're hoping that that comes to fruition.
Yeah, I'm actually curious about the form factor in terms of outfitting like individual soldiers in the way you would like a regular static camo. Is it able to achieve that same kind of form factor?
No, not yet. We're still dealing with the prototype. So I was limited in my prototypes to what I could buy off the shelf, commercial off the shelf, or COTS, they call it. And when you go to manufacture, you can actually integrate the lens in a manner that now that we know how it works, you can actually get it to the point that you counter a lot of the issues that you're running into out there. But saying it's going to turn into a uniform at this stage, we're not there yet. We're still at least a couple of years away from something getting to the point that it's close enough to the body that you wouldn't have to hold something in front of you. So right now it's another piece of equipment. It would basically be meant for hiding your movement or hiding your position, not necessarily as an assault item other than special forces looking at it to enter a room so that the bad guys can't see how many people are behind the shield or where to aim properly.
Yeah.
And if you can take away those two factors, that gives the guy at the front, usually the guy at the front entering the door is the lowest one on the totem pole.
Yeah. Right.
Because he's the first target entering the room. Well, you got to give him a chance, and you can do that with this material. And as we saw in the, Canadian terrorist attack where the guy was going through the House of Commons with his long gun.
Yeah.
If security had this set up in the hallway, and there's no place to hide in the hallway, right? They could have been able to ambush him in the hallway where they couldn't do it under normal circumstances. So there's a lot of different scenarios. And we actually went to a counterterrorism team in Europe with it, one of the best teams out there. And they tested it against motion detectors and heat sensors and brought me into the room and showed me. And I looked at them and I said, okay, like they had the alarm set up. So they showed me, the alarm goes off normally. Then they used my shield and it didn't go off. And I said, don't you guys have anything that can do that? They said, no, right? This is the first time we've ever been able to get past motion sensors
and heat detectors. Wait a minute. Did you just say with your invisibility cloak that you could like get past motion detectors?
Yes.
What?
Yeah. And that's what that's why I was saying earlier, right? It hides your motion, right? From an observer out there. Now, you may not be able to hide 100% of it, but in the goal of camouflage is about reducing the target. So if you can reduce it down to 5% of what it normally would be, and if you're someone's not looking directly at it, right, then they probably won't notice it. And it's all about the time you can give the user before the other side realizes they're there.
Yeah.
Right. So when we test camouflage, if we find something that is 4 seconds better than another camouflage, that's considered huge. Right. 4 seconds in a firefight is a lot. With the invisibility material, you're talking about tens of seconds or minutes. Right. So it's off the spectrum.
Yeah. No, my curiosity there was just when you said motion detectors in my head. Again, the way I visualize this, like with movies, but you know, I'm thinking like, you know, the way they have like lasers crisscross a room.
Yeah.
And that's why I was kind of curious how the cloak is able to beat like lasers.
Lasers, in the case of those lasers going across a room, if they disconnect, they will go off. So you're not going to defeat that with this material.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
But where you do defeat it is in like a LIDAR type system. So LIDAR is lasers that operate like radars. Oh, and okay. So if the LIDAR is looking for a target, a lot of self-driving cars use this technology. Not any of Elon Musk. He doesn't believe in LIDAR. He uses optics instead of LIDAR. And right. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but that's his perspective.
Yeah.
They see this 3D picture of objects around them and merge it with other sensors that they have, right? So most bumpers on vehicles, you see those little dots on the back bumper, those are radar. And so they can sense if the object is close by. So if you merge all these technologies, you get a better picture of what's around you.
Yeah.
It can't see through our material or the target. So it doesn't see the shield. And it doesn't see the target behind the shield. It just comes up as nothing is there.
Right.
And militaries use LIDAR all the time to look for targets. It's very short range compared to radar, but it's much more detailed than radar is. Radar can tell you there's a blob over there, but we kind of don't know what it is till it gets closer. Whereas LIDAR will go, oh, that's a telephone pole. So you have different areas where these technologies get used. But in the case of a single laser hitting this material, it's not going to be able to hit the target behind it if we've designed the material properly.
Right. So, you know, you kind of alluded to this as you spoke there. You mentioned that it would have been a good idea for this technology to be classified. And I can see why, because it can get into the wrong hands, i.e., you know, the atomic bomb certainly has gotten into hands that we're not entirely comfortable with at the moment. And my thought there is, what is your biggest fear with this technology, the invisibility cloak specifically?
The nefarious uses that people, I mean, whenever people talk about what's your favorite superpower out there? Most people say flying or invisibility, but if it's an anonymous test, normally it's invisibility.
Yeah. Right?
If people don't actually have to give their name because of the nefarious uses you could use for invisibility out there. So if you've got a product that can get past motion sensors and heat sensors, well, that's the core of a lot of security systems out there, right? It shouldn't be available to the criminal element or Joe Public, right? In my view.
Yeah.
There's so many people that would, if given the opportunity, may think of using it in the wrong way out there.
Right.
And that has always been a concern, let alone the bad guys having access to it. And now all your technology that you've developed to put NATO and the United States at the forefront of military technology, this in the wrong hands can counter much of that, if not almost all of that. And that's where I said it needs to be classified, right?
Yeah.
Even the commanding general of MARSOC, the U.S. Marine Forces Special Forces Command, or Special Operations Command, he agreed with me. He said, this should be classified. Right? Why isn't it? And I'm like, Canada doesn't want to classify it. They don't see it the same way you do. They have different views on defense and military and everything. Not to say they're right or wrong. It just they operate differently than the Americans do.
Yeah.
And so I spent almost a decade trying to get it classified. And I knew when the patents were published, that's no longer
done.
Possible.
Yeah.
Right. And we didn't know when the patents were going to get published. Right. We just knew they were in the mix. Right. That the clock was ticking. One day you just get told, oh, it's published. Right. And at that point, you can never classify it again at that point. But now the adversaries have a blueprint to how to make it. Right. So you've given away, that's part of the trade-off when you take out a patent. Yes, you get all the rights to it for 20 years.
Yeah.
But you also lose the ability to protect any trade secrets that might be there. Yeah. And had we kept this quiet, right? Had the government stepped in and classified it, the military could have used it for, my guess, 5 to 10 years at least before it ever got figured out.
Right.
By other groups. And it might have lasted longer than that. Right.
How vague were you? Are you? I haven't read the patent, but I know there are ways that people are able to deliberately, you know, obscure certain elements of the actual tech, so while still protecting their rights to the technology.
You can. The problem is you really need to lay out if it's a new item, new technology, you need to lay out every aspect of how it works and why it works. So we have a couple trade secrets on how to bond this properly, but I mean, that's going to get discovered fairly rapidly, I believe. So there's not a lot you can protect that way if you go the patent route, right? And that just speaks to how patents function, right? Show us a blueprint, explain how it works. Even if you don't have a prototype, there needs to be some science behind why it works that way. It's funny because the European Patent Office came to us when we filed our holographic like video patent, where we're using our lenses. So we'd have one lens set up in this configuration, one lens set up in this configuration, and there'd be a gap. There'd be a gap of 20 inches between the two. And we'd shine a projected image onto the first one. It would scatter it. And then it would recombine on the second one 20 inches away into the proper picture.
Yeah.
And they came and they said, explain how that works. Mm-hmm. And we're like, you don't need to for a patent. You just need to prove that it works. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it does work. I believe that there's quantum physics behind what we're actually seeing there. And I don't want to go down a path that's going to be very confusing to people, but I'll be doing some videos on this over the next couple of months.
Yeah.
Kind of discussing what I think is happening here on the quantum side. So people have always kind of said, oh, you call your invisibility material quantum stealth. That's just a marketing term, right? No, it's not. And with our laser splitter, where we can split a laser into 20 million lasers, we actually see an interference pattern that I've had other physicists say, yeah, that's an interference pattern caused by quantum physics, quantum mechanics. And so we know it's happening with these lenses, right? It's just a matter of comprehending and understanding why it happens. And in the realm of quantum, sometimes you just don't know, right? Why it works. It just works. And so that was the funny thing when the European office came to us, explain what's happening here. Well, that's not required for a patent. And this is the best guess right now, but that shouldn't hinder the decision on filing a patent. It just showed how curious they were as to why it was working.
Yeah. Yeah. Now my other curiosity there, obviously we've talked about the camouflage applications of this tech, but I wonder if there are other potential applications that maybe a lot of people don't necessarily think about, obviously apart from paintball as well.
Probably the biggest requests we get are from the TV industry. So they're trying to hide cameramen that might be at a live event like the awards shows, so that they can get them a lot closer to the front where they need to be. We get a lot of requests from the architectural industry, where they're going, we have to put in these beams for structural integrity. We really don't want to because it doesn't match with what we're trying to do architecturally, but it has to be there. So how can we make them invisible? So those are a few. The movie industry one I expected, the architectural one, it makes sense, but I didn't really anticipate that at the start. And you can also go too far with it. We worked with the Bureau of Land Management in the US on camouflaging their storage tanks for visual mitigation. Yeah. It's not for security. It's just to make the landscape look less scarred than 600 oil tanks out there in Colorado.
Right.
And so they said, well, these static camouflage patterns that you have are great, but could we do better? And I said, well, you can, but you got to be careful because you allow hunters on these lands, right? And they go, yeah. And I said, you don't want them shooting at one of these tanks, not knowing there is a tank there. and they said, right. And I said, yeah, you don't want to make it invisible. So there are some drawbacks sometimes, right, that you need to kind of think through to say, is this going to be a viable option, right? Do you want someone walking into a concrete pole at eye level that they otherwise would have seen, yeah, right? So you don't want to make it completely invisible out there. Yeah, those are just a couple of the sides. And I get fashion designers contacting me all the time saying, can we get your material for a fashion show or something like that? Not right now.
That's interesting. I think this is leading me into the ghost technology, mm-hmm, and I'd like to get into that. But working with the government, there's obviously a whole craze right now with people wanting to find out about like what's hidden under the hood, what's going on in the classifieds, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
With, you know, people suggesting maybe aliens have visited us in the past and stuff like that. Since you've worked with the government so much, just on the down low here, just
yeah,
have aliens visited us in the past? Do you know?
My view may not be everyone's cup of tea out there, but I looked at, because my expertise is in air ions, I looked at a lot of the evidence that had been compiled on the unidentified objects that were out there, the ones that the U.S. Air Force or other groups couldn't actually come up with a solution for. And I looked at the evidence and said, wow, that really sounds like they're using ion propulsion, right? And you can go on YouTube and see people using ion propulsion. They basically charge some tinfoil, and if you've got this balsa wood structure, it'll actually float, yeah, because you're repelling the natural negative electrical field of the surface of the earth.
Right.
And if you do that on a larger scale, it'll still work. And so years ago, I recognized that that's probably what was being done here. It wasn't aliens. It was the government at some of the highest levels probably using this technology for whatever reason. You probably, without nuclear power, you wouldn't want to be flying these things with nuclear propulsion in the first place. But without nuclear power, you could only fly them for 30 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
So they would have very limited range, but they would have no noise or very little noise. It might be have a hum if you were close to them. It would smell like ozone, which is what you see in a lot of these reports.
Yeah.
It would glow, and it would glow different colors like we see with the northern lights. You can't stop that with ionization. That's just a byproduct of, if you ionize something more, you're going to get more of a glow out of it.
Yeah.
And some of the trace elements found at landing sites that had almost a pure magnesium, well, that's what you would use on a craft like that. And yeah, and so, and why would someone fly across the universe in something the size of a F-150, Ford F-150, right? You also need to look at our genetic structure of every living thing. All complex life on this planet shares the exact same DNA. Like even corn shares like 45% of its DNA with us.
Oh,
and so that only ever happened once in the whole history of the planet, right? So I'm not saying that there's not single-celled organism planets out there that exist all through the universe. That doesn't seem to be super difficult. It's the complex life that we know has only ever happened once, because there's no other evidence of any other competing. If it did come up, it got wiped out right away. Mm. So what they figure from all the genetic studies out there is it happened once and once only. And we all, the blades of the grass, every human being owes our existence to that one event that happened. Mm. So when we look at the universe and 2 trillion galaxies and everything, there must be life out there. We start actually finding that our solar system is very unique. we thought it was the model for all solar systems out there. No, we're rare. Our star is the most second stable star that we found in the Milky Way galaxy, is like four times less stable than our sun. We tend to have the most stable star out there. So very unique properties. Even our galaxy and the carbon and the amount of carbon in our galaxy is unique to all the other galaxies out there. So for life to form from what we know here, I'm not saying there couldn't be silicone-based life forms like an alien out there, but if this holds true, right, if complex life has to have carbon, those galaxies that don't have the carbon, there won't be complex life on any of those planets, hundreds of billions of planets in that galaxy, right? So I think we're very unique. I think we may be unique enough to be the only one in the universe. So when someone postulates, are we being visited by aliens? My first reaction is going to be, I don't think so, but it's never going to be never. Because as someone, I can't call myself a scientist, I can call myself an inventor. But as someone who studies science, right, I have to say there is a probability, right? So, but I think if people were more educated about how rare complex life actually is, and how the actual distances between stars, right, the closest star to us is 4 light years away, right? It would take a spaceship a couple hundred years to get there with our current technology, right? So even if we could get close to the speed of light, you're still looking at a couple of years to get there, right? More than four anyway. And that is a very difficult thing to accomplish to life that may not be as prevalent as most people think, right? Because that's what you're looking for when you go out there. Oh, we're hoping to find complex life out there. You're unlikely going to find it even in our neighborhood, right? And probably not even in the extended neighborhood out there. So I would love, I'm a big sci-fi guy, right? I would love there to be aliens all over the place, right? It'd be a little scary if there were, because a lot of them would have some ulterior motives. But the reality of what we know and what we're learning each and every day keeps bringing that number down for me, right? Do I expect it to actually exist? No. It keeps going lower with all the discoveries. And the James Webb Telescope is making further discoveries that is kind of rocking a lot of cosmology out there. But it is also answering some of those questions for us too, and making it very apparent that we might be by ourselves in this universe out there. It makes it critical that we take care of this place that we're in. It's very unique.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe I'll link that into climate change and how, you know, there's obviously been this talks about, what if climate change is irreversible? Are we able to establish a civilization, you know, somewhere off planet?
Yeah.
And I wonder what you think of the possibility. Obviously, you've spoken a little bit about the fact that this kind of stable ecosystem we have, semi-stable ecosystem that we have, is a rarity. But I wonder what you think of the possibility of I shouldn't say colonizing, but populating an off-planet system.
It'll get done. Guys like Elon Musk will do it. Right. And it's amazing what he's able to do with SpaceX right now. I mean, they're showing the government way of doing things is just not even able to keep up in any way, shape, or form with what he's capable of doing. So we're going to get there. But do we want to get there? Right. Mars doesn't have an electromagnetic field to protect the atmosphere and any residents that might be on the surface. So you got to come up with solutions to put them under the surface, or new materials have to be developed for habitats and whatnot. You can't take off your helmet, right? You're not gonna terraform something, not even in the next couple of hundred years that we know of, that'll make something similar to Earth, right? We all talk about Earth 2.0, but there, from what we've seen out there, there's not gonna be a lot of options. We've got hundreds of moons in our solar system to look at, and some of the atmospheres are full of methane, right? And Venus, you'd melt within seconds. And so there's not a lot of options for us out there. So do we want to move parts of the population to other areas of the solar system to protect it? Probably, but if something happened here, their lifeline might not last long, right? And it'd be hard to be self-sufficient anywhere but Earth right now. So talking about climate change, I mean, we know that the commercial airliners, there's 1 million people in the air at any one time.
Right.
And those are all flying through the most critical parts of our atmosphere. And that exhaust is going right out into that area and doing things with that that they don't fully understand. If NASA has to come to me, right, a guy who has no letters behind his name, and ask me about the ionosphere and the interaction of air ions, we're in big trouble, right? Mm. But people tend to think they know a lot more than they do, right? And humans tend to, and there was one point when they were going to stop issuing patents, this was many years ago, because they thought we'd come up with every idea that you could come up with, right? And that is people being arrogant about their knowledge, right?
Yeah.
We don't know everything. We're always learning. If you don't know the answer, just say, I don't know. That should be acceptable rather than saying yes or no. I've been to cultures where they don't have that. They will tell you yes or no, even if they don't know. And so you run into problems all the time, right? And same thing happens in everyday conversations out there with people as well, right? Everyone wants to appear that they know more than they do, and they don't want to look stupid. And in the end, they end up making themselves look stupid by saying something that they shouldn't say out there.
We've talked about, you know, the way like the government does classify stuff that really we shouldn't be getting, or maybe we want to get involved, I don't know. But there's obviously been a clamor. I don't know if you listen to the Joe Rogan podcast and you know,
I've heard a few of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And how people are so interested in getting to know what the government is hiding under the hood. Having worked with a lot of governments and had experiences with government, do we want to know what the government is hiding?
They are hiding things for a good reason. Right. There are countries in this world that would use technology or information to try and ruin us. And so the best defense is a good offense sometimes, right? Sometimes you don't want to tell the other guys what your secret is, right? The stealth fighter, right? The F-117 stealth fighter, it was kept secret for a long time. The SR-71, that was kept secret for years, right? They actually used UFOs as an argument, right, to some of the sightings. Oh no, that's a UFO out there, right? And so you can use that to your benefit out there. Disinformation is so powerful. That means you're saying a little bit of truth and then mixing in lies with it, right?
Yeah.
We've had to do it with hyperstealth a few times to hide some of our information about camouflage, about what works and what doesn't work. Because A, we don't want our competitors knowing everything that we know about it. And we definitely don't want our adversaries knowing what works and what doesn't work. So in the battlefield right now, I can see camouflage patterns being used by the bad guys that are so ineffective that it would have been better if they didn't have one in the first place, right? But I also see problems with the camouflage industry where, like, just baffled me, where the opposing sides, sometimes in a country like Syria, there might be 4 or 5 different groups battling each other, right? Yeah. And they're all wearing the same camouflage, right? So you got to put, like in Ukraine, you got to put yellow or blue tape if you're Ukrainian on your uniform, and the Russians are using white or red sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, that totally defeats the whole purpose of camouflage.
It does.
Right?
It really does.
And so now you don't know who is who, right? Camouflage is not just to conceal yourself. It is also to identify yourself.
Yeah.
Right. So the minute that a country allows their camouflage to get commercially used or to be used, so this is where we differ from other other companies that sell camouflage. We don't sell to everyone. Mm. I would love to. I would love to have that ability to generate more revenue for our company. Yeah. But we restrict that camouflage so that country, like Jamaica, is the only country that has access to those patterns. So there's a fewer chances for them to deal with someone trying to infiltrate, right? This is what happened in Afghanistan before we sent our camouflage there, was they were using that old U.S. woodland that we saw in the Rock or in the Rambo movies. And the bad guys were finding it or buying it and infiltrating and killing innocent people or soldiers by getting past all these guards and other things because they looked like the actual army there.
Yeah.
So that has always surprised me that the Americans didn't stop their camouflage from being used by all these different groups around the world, right? All these different countries. It's going to make a mess if you get into a larger conflict out there, where it no one's going to know who anyone is at that point in time.
Speaking of misdirection, I want to get into your ghost tech now. And if you could just explain in simple terms what I have an idea what it is, but I'd like for you to kind of like break it down for us, what the ghost tech is and how it achieves misdirection.
So ghost tech is that system where we're creating the holographic image, where we're using this technique, and we could do either way, right? It works both ways. And we're creating a video image or even a static image on that material to simulate a soldier, a wall, a bush that's not actually there. And in the case of putting like a hologram that looks like a soldier, if you look at our videos, they look very washed out. And we believe that's part of the quantum element that's going on. It's called a photon avalanche. It's overwhelming the sensor of the camera, and the camera's trying to compensate for extra light. So I went down to Softworks in Tampa. So they're the civilian wing for Special Operations Command. Yeah. And they invited me down there to give a demonstration for this actual technology, the ghost tech that you're talking about. And I showed a riot shield, and I put a projected image of myself in a uniform on it, and I'm standing right beside it, and I'm 6 feet in front of a special operator. And he said, "I can't tell the difference between which one's real and which one's not." So when you watch the videos, you need to take that into account, that you're not seeing the same thing that you do personally, where you don't have computer sensors actually identifying that. Now, it would be a good technique to identify it, right? Mm-hmm. But now you got to carry a camera around with you and look through the camera all the time to see if someone's using this technology. Right. But in the heat of battle, that's not typically something someone's going to do. So in the case, what got me thinking about this was in Afghanistan, you would get these little fortresses that would be defended by minimal teams, like teams of 8 or 10 special forces guys.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the bad guys would surround them and there'd be hundreds. And if you had a technology like this, you could pop 100 of these and make it look like there was a force of at least 100 there, right? Mm-hmm. And they would draw the fire, because if you had videos of them holding guns and shooting, well, the bad guys are going to think, well, that's the guys we need to shoot, right?
Yeah.
And if your bullet goes through this material, it's not going to wreck the material. It's just going to put a hole in it, and it's still going to function,
right?
So it's just going to keep shooting, and you're going to keep shooting at that, wasting your ammunition. Well, the real guys can either take cover and wait for defense to come in, or can do what they need to do. Or you could even parachute these things behind the enemy and get them to think that they're being surrounded. You could put these on a golf cart to make it look like there's an M1 Abrams tank there. Mm. You could put it on a drone to make it look like there's a attack helicopter, right? That's coming out of that fortress, right? When it, in fact, it's a little drone with this material wrapped around it and a few projectors. So that is big. In World War II, there was the Ghost Army, and they were credited. They actually just received an award last week, I believe.
Right.
They received numerous awards for getting Germany to actually think that the attack was going to take place very much north of where it did take place.
Right.
And they put all their resources there because the Ghost Army had all these blow up tanks and boats and everything that they had accumulated. And they actually put Patton in charge of this. And the Germans, Patton was already in the bad books. So he was being relegated to this title only position, really. But the Germans fell for it and thought this was going to be where the main attack was going to come from. So they didn't move their resources down to Normandy.
Yeah.
They left them up in northern France. And even for days after that, they thought, oh no, the real attack's still going to come. So we can't move our resources down there. By the time they figured it out, they had already pushed too far for them to be stopped. And that was the end of the war, right? Was that first push. Deception is huge. It's massively important. If you can put this material in the back of a troop transport where a drone or a satellite or an observer over top can look down and see 20 troops in the back of that truck moving to point A, and then you turn off the projector when you come back and it looks empty, you now think there's 20 troops at point A, right? That's how easy deception can be, right? So people tend to underestimate that particular aspect, but it can save lives. It can win wars. That may be even more important technology for the military than our invisibility is, right? But you can use that in conjunction with our invisibility technology to put something on the front of your shield so that the bad guys don't react the minute the door opens, right? Something looks very normal to them, right? It might be their own commanding officer on that shield. Well, they're not going to pick up their guns at that point. Yeah. That gives you a few seconds to look around the room and find out where the hostages are so you don't accidentally kill those hostages, right? So when I deal with my special forces friends and whatnot, this is a big part of what they do, right? Going in and clearing rooms and making sure that the people you're trying to rescue don't get shot in the process. And you can't do that just by going in and spraying a room. You need to actually have this understanding of what's happening out there, and you need time to do so. So how do we give them that time, right? You can do that in a number of ways, but this can help them in that path.
Interesting. Your description, that I can see this being of use to people that practice, you know, illusions and magic too, right? Not real magic, because I don't believe let's not get into magic.
Yeah.
but like the magic in the sense of people that practice illusions, I can see that being something that people really get into. But there's another piece of technology that your company has invented that I think is truly amazing, which is the Odeclipse technology. And you know, I'd like for you to kind of break that down in terms of, obviously, that solves a specific problem in terms of preventing dead zones. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but dead zones around the solar panel, right? That's my understanding of what your Odeclipse technology does.
Yeah, so an eclipse, right? You're blocking out the sun. Odeclipse to me is the opposite, right? You're creating more sunlight, and that's what we're essentially doing. But Odeclipse is a specific trade name we've used to hide shadows that are getting in front of solar panels. So if you have a solar panel that's the size of the picture behind me, and you create a shadow on it that is this big, it will cause 90% of that energy running through that to diminish.
Right.
And so shadows become critical, right? So you can't have any overhead power lines. You can't have trees blowing in front. It makes a huge difference. The actual major part of the technology, though, is our solar amplifier, right? So Odeclipse is to stop shadows. The solar amplifier, using the same lenticular lenses, right? So what we do is we put something called diffraction grating behind it. So I'll show you what diffraction grating is. See if this shows up.
Supposed to collimate the light, I imagine, right?
Yeah, you can see the lights in the back there.
Yeah. I can see those dots.
Yeah. So we use a couple of these, and we turn them on angles, right? So that just populate. See if I've got anything on there. I don't know if you can see that there, but
yeah, those ones are harder to see, but I can see them a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And so by doing that and adding a lenticular lens to it, we can actually create with a laser over 10 million lasers. If we use a mirror underneath that diffraction grating and the lenticular lens on top, what it does is it triples the amount of output. If you've arranged them in a way that the, if this is your solar panel here, what we're doing is we're trying to deflect light off that onto this, right? So you're angling like the flowers of a petal or a satellite dish. You're trying to bring more sunlight in. You're intensifying the amount of light that hits that panel. So we're not modifying the panel. We're just modifying what's around that panel to create more sunlight to hit it. Right. And we found that we can triple output. So I don't know why this hasn't become more of a bigger story out there, because you see stories about someone getting 2% more efficiency out of a solar panel, and it ends up making news all around the world. And I'm going, I can triple that, right? Triple, like we're talking 200%, right? Yeah. It sometimes things don't make sense to me like that, but that's what we've just gotten the patents for in Canada and the US.
Yeah.
And there's a few divisional patents, so they're slightly different inventions, but they're affiliated with it. And that we didn't know if we were going to get the American one. So you have to go back and forth with the patent examiners on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
To get them to understand if there was a complex subject, it might not be very easily understood. The drawing might be, they might be looking at it differently. So there's a lot of factors that go in. But patent examiners are some of the smartest people in the world. Even Einstein was a patent examiner at one point.
Yeah.
So it's not that they're not able to comprehend it. It's just that they're looking at it differently, right? So a lot of the times when you're going back and forth with them, it's like, oh, no, like I was saying earlier, how they would look at the lenses like that and assume that's what we were doing. And it was like, no, we're splitting them, right? They're offset from each other. Oh, okay, that makes sense, right? So with the solar side, when we got that American one, a lot of people didn't believe we were going to get anything, any claims, right? And they ended up giving us a pile of them. So it justified what we were doing was unique. I mean, to get a patent, it can't be seen anywhere on the web, in a scientific paper, in a previous patent application, or a previous patent. If they see it anywhere in anything, right? And nowadays, their search techniques are way better than when my grandfather was filing for patents, right?
Yeah,
they had to go through filing cabinets before. Now they can research 20 million documents for 5 seconds.
And especially look with AI too, right? With AI, it can go through those a bit more,
Yeah, to get a patent nowadays is much, much more difficult than it was in my grandfather's time, right? Yeah. So even though you file a patent, that doesn't mean you're going to get it. Right. Mm-hmm. So to actually get granted 11 patents so far out of all the ones that we filed, and we've been granted patents in all four of our applied technologies out there, the invisibility, the lights, laser splitting, the solar amplifier, and the holographic like images.
One of the things I'm curious about, I guess, is with, I'm going to bring it back to education and the sciences, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've taught or had any exposure to the curriculum in schools these days in terms of scientific education, but there is a lot of worry amongst people in academia that, you know, science is not being taught correctly or not being taught properly, or the kids are unwilling to learn science. And I wonder what your opinion of scientific education is at the moment, and how you think we should be viewing scientific education going forward in order to ensure that, you know, we're still as a race able to continue to chart a course for development.
So I'm not a teacher, so this question shouldn't hold a lot of weight, right? Or my answer shouldn't hold a lot of weight. But I do find some of the basics of scientific understanding that most people should have, they don't have, right? Whether that was because they didn't pay attention in school or because schools are pushing students through. In my, when I went to school, people actually failed. They don't fail anymore, right? And I've talked, we have friends that are teachers and they're like, oh, to fail a student, it almost never happens now. The paperwork is just out of this world, right? So they kind of push the kids all the way through, give them their degree, when in reality, they really didn't earn it in the first place, right? The emphasis on sciences in a lot of areas, from what I've heard, have taken a backdoor to the social aspect of what they're teaching out there.
Right.
And that's a problem. When I went to school, we could choose physics, biology, or chemistry. Right. Very few would take more than one of those. And you only had to get a C plus to get through, right?
Yeah.
Or a C, C minus to get through, actually. So there's not a lot of incentive for us to learn and understand those particular aspects, right?
Yeah.
It has to be outside of the educational system. And luckily with the internet, luckily and unluckily, because the internet, if I go through YouTube, I love watching YouTube. There is so much garbage on there from people talking about things that they have no business talking about.
Yeah.
Right. I look up this person that's talking about what James Webb just discovered, and I'm like, okay, and are you a physicist? Are you this? Right. So, and the same can be said of me, right? Talking about some of these things, right? But I don't claim to be one of these people. I'm an inventor, right? Mm-hmm. And I have a unique perspective on these things. But I do think we do a disservice to the general population when they don't understand some of the most basic principles out there, right? We saw that during COVID, right? And we see it more now than we saw it back then, is there is a distrust on scientists. And the scientists are going, like, we're trying to help. We're trying to prevent people from getting
dying, yeah,
very sick and having long lifelong problems or dying. And technology has allowed us to create this and this and this, and this is how it works. And then you get people on there going, no, you should be taking this. And you're going, okay, so are you a doctor? Well, not really, but you wouldn't know that from watching the video, right? And that information gets shared on TikTok in that 30-second thing, and that becomes the understanding of the younger generation, right? So I was saying this with a friend of mine the other day, it's as if we've gotten to the point where people my age and your age and younger are looking at the headline and the caption, and that's their understanding of the story, and they don't read the article. I can see from my YouTube videos, the drop off is usually after 1 minute to 2 minutes.
Yep. Right?
And so I'm going, you would never pick up a book and read the first two chapters and drop it. The most exciting stuff is always in the last 30 seconds, right?
Yeah.
Where everything culminates and it answers the questions, and people all miss that, right?
Now, speaking of education, I think earlier in this conversation, you told me about, like, you know, the challenge of gaining credibility when you don't have those three letters behind your name. But my point is, you know, obviously for what you do, that you've kind of alluded to the fact that maybe a lot more credibility would have been ascribed to you with a few more letters behind your name, which is silly, really, considering all the stuff that you've achieved and all the stuff that you've done, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I wonder how you speak to the importance of education with a perspective towards, like, the younger generation coming in, growing up in this sort of a different world right now.
Yeah. Well, my situation was very unique, like very, very unique. I would not tell someone to follow my path and do what I did, right? Because I'm 57 now, and that is a long time to wait to get to the point that people will actually pay attention to what you're saying without any post-secondary schooling. My advice is go and get that degree and make sure it's not a degree in something that can be written off, right? that there is some value to your degree. And then I know people that just keep going back and getting more and more degrees and letters behind their name and understanding. And that's great, right? That's an appetite for discovery and curiosity. And we need people that know what they're talking about. When you see some of the problems with structures being built and then falling over or collapsing in a certain area, and you're going, how did that person who engineered that get their degree? Did they get 51% on their degree? Right? Do I want the dentist or the doctor dealing with me to have gotten 51%? Right?
Right.
No, go out and try and get the best that you can out there. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, my situation is very different. Right. And if I had to do it over again, I would have gone to post-secondary education, trying to do what I did, but also getting some letters so that some of those doors would have opened for me sooner. Rather than later, right?
I want to bring it back to your team that founded, because as you mentioned, you had a group of people that helped you found HyperStealth.
Yeah.
And I want to know how that came together and how the name, well, the team and the name, how that came to be.
Well, there's my friend Gino Jamma. He actually went to school with my aunt. And knew my grandfather. And I had been posting papers. This was in, so we formed the company in March 1999. So we've just turned 25.
Wow.
And he wanted to do an anti-claustrophobic hyperbaric chamber. So these are chambers that are used in hospitals to treat carbon monoxide poisoning. They use it for divers when they surface too quickly.
Yeah.
Because nitrogen bubbles will expand in their bloodstream and that can actually kill them, right?
Yeah.
Or cause major injuries.
Yeah.
So Vancouver Hospital has one to treat gas gangrene, people with diabetes where they're about to lose a limb or a digit or a toe or a finger. And I think there's about 13 approved conditions. And he was looking at making these commercial available hyperbaric chambers.
Yeah.
And I had written a number of articles on the Canucks, Vancouver Canucks had been using a hyperbaric chamber, and I had warned them in 93, 94 not to use it for all our players, only use it for injured players. Well, they ended up using it for all our players. And if for people my age, it's a long walk back, but that was the year they actually went to the Stanley Cup, but they didn't have home ice advantage.
Oh,
and they
yeah.
were called Team Schizophrenic because they played so well on the road and so poorly at home. And I had warned the general manager before the events occurred, before these problems occurred, that this is what was going to happen, right?
Right.
If you put your players in there, they're going to lose their endurance. They're going to lose their balance. They're going to lose their reaction time, right?
Right.
And that because they... all games they played were seven games, they actually had an advantage because they were away from their home ice for one of those games.
Yeah.
And they had one of the best penalty kills on the road, one of the worst at home, one of the best power plays on the road, one of the worst at home. They'd never seen these statistics before. And yet
wild.
I had predicted it to Pat Quinn before it even happened, right?
Yeah.
And so Gino Jamma had actually saw that article and said, well, I'm making hyperbaric chambers. Do you have a solution? And I said, oh, as a matter of fact, I do, using air ions, right? The reason these problems are occurring is there's no ions in the air that you're breathing in those chambers. And everywhere you go, unless you're in a submarine, you're breathing in some quantity of air ions. The Russians did experiments on animals in deionized air. So they were breathing every chemical that you and I are breathing right now, and they all died within a few weeks because they didn't have that electrical potential in the chemicals that they were breathing. That is, they said that's a prerequisite for life. So when we jump back to what you said about going to Mars and the moon and the whole bit, they don't have the ions. We're going to have to farm those ions, figure out a way to produce them. So I had come up with a passive negative ion generator. So a normal ion generator uses a spark discharge. So basically it pulls the positive back into the wall and only spits negative electrical potential to the end of a tungsten needle. Yeah. And it gets to that needle and it's got nowhere else to go and it spits it into the air. And those attach themselves to oxygen molecules. Yeah. And you breathe that in. Negative ions are good for you. Positive ions are bad for you. No ions are really bad for you. And that was the problem with the hyperbaric chamber. So I said, yeah, I got a solution. So what the other two people were Robert Dimont and Roy Tegelta, and they were the business co-founders.
Yeah.
So Gino got the group of us together. He knew the other two guys and we formed Hyperstealth. So the name Hyperstealth actually came from hyperbaric chambers and the passive negative ion generator. There was no camouflage in there at all. That wasn't, so the fact that the name works now is amazing, but very much a fluke, right? So I was the one who came up with the name. And back then it was all about .com. What can we find that's easy to remember and is a .com name? And I went through a list of like 100 names and came up with that one, right? So hyperbaric chambers actually were in their heyday at that point. There were a few private chambers locally. They were doing great business. And then the BC College of Physicians stepped in and said, if you're going to run these, you'll only be able to treat these 13 conditions and you'll have to have a doctor on staff. Mm-hmm. And we're like, so in other words, everyone go down to Vancouver Hospital and get free treatment, right? Why would they come to us? Because they treat the exact same things down there, right? So the a lot of the business that was being done back then was on cerebral palsy, right? They thought there was subjective evidence that it was helping out these kids that couldn't talk.
Yeah.
Going in there for multiple treatments. And that's when the BC College of Physicians stepped in. And I can't say whether it was right or wrong, but they were trying to protect the public, right?
Yeah.
And saying, well, there's not enough objective evidence here, right? We don't know what the dangers are and all those different aspects, right? So anyway, the long story short, they pulled the ability. And so we had to find something different. We couldn't be a hyperbaric chamber company anymore. So I at that point thought, well, I've got the camouflage thing. I'll bring that in rather than shutting the company down. Yeah. So I could have done that myself, all the camouflage, and I'd have millions of dollars to my name right now, but I didn't because I have a CEO hat on, right? I've got to do whatever it takes to these investors put their trust in me to try and make them back their investment and then some, right? So how do I do that? And the same thing with the inventions. None of these inventions were the founders, right? Mm-hmm. Other than myself. It wasn't my grandpa. It was just me. And I'm sitting there going, I could do this myself. But Hyperstealth needs it, right? And we need to get more value in the company. So it went from being a Guy Kramer thing to a Hyperstealth thing at that point in time. So again, I won't be the one who pockets everything, but that doesn't bother me, right? I'm very much like my grandfather. I don't need to be a multi-billionaire out there. And a lot of people find that odd, right?
Like
that is when you ask people what they want to be. Oh, I want to be an influencer when I grow up, right? Very few people get to do that. When I was a kid, it used to be a pilot, a police officer, a doctor, right?
An engineer.
Those were the things. Now, no, I want to be an influencer, right? Yep. So very, very, very different, right? In the way people kind of perceive wealth and fame. And I'm very, very much an introvert, unless you get me in one of these interviews, right?
Yeah.
And people have said that, like, okay, I was in a big group and you weren't talking to too many people because I don't like a bunch of people around me, right? I love people. I just don't, my personality, I'd rather be one-on-one with someone.
Yeah.
Right. But if you get me talking about my stuff, right, the camouflage or the technology, I love talking about that stuff. It's my passion, right? So, I mean, you and I worked in the same building and you and I really, most we ever said to each other was hi, right?
Yeah.
So that it just who I am, right?
Right. So I'm curious, obviously, at some point you mentioned the next phase for the company at the moment is getting to a point where you can mass produce at least one of the products, which is the camouflage.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the approach is for for you at, or for the company at the moment in terms of taking this company to the, what's the next level and what is the approach that you're taking to get there?
We had assumed incorrectly. So I've made lots of assumptions over my years as a CEO, and a lot of them haven't come to fruition, right? Doesn't mean I was wrong. It just means that other people didn't perceive it the same way I did, right? So I assumed, right, and our board thought that we were going to get acquired long before this point, right? And I've actually talked to people out of Silicon Valley, and they said, well, you've got a couple of problems. One is you aren't in Silicon Valley. And number two, you're not American, right? If either of those two were true, you would have a lineup of people waiting to buy you out there. But you're still an unknown person, right? Even though we had the story go viral a number of times over the years, we had our 15 minutes of fame here and there, right? It lasted a couple of weeks.
Right. But
I run into people all the time that have never heard of HyperStealth and don't know about the invisibility, right? There's so much on the internet that just drowns out what we're doing that we're still relatively unknown out there. And so to companies that might be looking to acquire us, right, a defense type company, we may only be on a little bit of the radar of people that don't really matter in that company in that capacity, right? So my job is just to keep creating more value in the company, right? Making sure that these the patent examiner's questions are answered with my patent attorney. Then the patent attorney typically does most of the work for us, right?
Yeah.
And then he'll come back to me and he'll go, "We're having some trouble with this part." And then I'll go back and I'll write like 8 pages of my own stuff and go back with that. But staying on top of that stuff, not letting it get, because there's a timeline on every one of our patents, right?
Yeah, so
you have to respond within 3 months or weeks or whatever, right? When and because we filed in over 50 countries, usually there's one or two major things that happen each week.
That's
right?
A lot.
And the great thing is a lot of them have been, "Oh guy, you just got approved for China for the light bending," right? And you're going, "I thought they were rejecting us. They just approved 70 claims. Like what happened? What changed their mind?" Right?
Yeah.
In 2024, we've actually had a lot of very good news coming out. And that's exciting because that creates value. Every time a patent is added to the company, that is much more value to the company. So if someone is looking to buy us, there's more value there in our company. It actually makes us more expensive, right? At that point in time, right? Because a patent is like gold, right? It allows you a monopoly on the country you filed in for 20 years. A legal monopoly. No one can compete with you for that 20 years, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't understand that. But it can take 5 years from filing a patent to getting issued a patent.
Right.
But you can also go backwards and to the time you filed and go after anyone who infringed on you in that window.
Oh, interesting.
It's not from the time they issue it. It's from the time you file
it. But
I can't legally go after someone who's infringed until they grant, and then I can go back and go after them, right? And in a lot of cases, every dollar of profit they made, every dollar of royalty that we would have made, and then in the U.S., the judges can actually triple the penalties, right? If in patent infringement, so it can ruin companies if they decide, oh, they won't go after us, right? They haven't come after us yet. That we got 6 years under the rules in the U.S. before we have to go after someone. So if they start infringing today, I don't have to go after them in court for another 5+ years, right?
Yeah.
So in all that time, they're still infringing. I can still, and it's within my limitations to wait that long to go after them if I choose to do so, right? So there's a lot of things going on that side, trying to promote the technologies to make them more understandable. That's part of one of the reasons why I'm doing this with you, right? Because get, if I go on a news feed, CTV or Global or whatever, I've got 5 minutes or less, right? Yes. And they tell me ahead of time and I'm going, "How do you explain invisibility in 5 minutes or less?" Right? Or our company, right? There's just so much there that you can't pack it into that, right? So I can talk about the invisibility, but then I lose on the solar panel, right?
Yeah.
I can't talk about the solar panel at that site. So yeah, interviews like this allow me to kind of really go into the depths of my motivation, my background, what the technologies are capable of doing, where we stand right now. So yeah, what we really need is that financial input from a group, which we think might be coming to get to the manufacturing stage. So right now, all of it is in prototype stage, right?
Yeah.
So some of it, like the holographic like material, you can buy commercial off the shelf lenses and do that tomorrow, right? So there's not a lot of work there. On the invisibility, there's going to be some work to, because for me to do one of those shields that I hold up in the videos, that would take almost a week to do one.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I, that was with an assistant. I'm no longer have an assistant. I'm just working by myself. Right. And so, the next stage is going to be someone else manufacturing. It won't be me. Right. Yeah. I don't expect it will be me. I don't want it to be us. That's not our forte, right? As a one person operation, right? Let the actual people that manufacture lenses take that on. They've got that expertise. Let them do it.
Yeah.
Same thing with the solar. Let the solar companies take that on, and they know what needs to be done and how it should be done. I just need to provide that oversight at the start and say, here's how to do it properly. You guys then engineer how to actually implement it, right?
Yeah.
I figured out how to triple a solar panel output and then reduce the heat from it. Here's what we've got. Here's what you can use, and go at it. Right. So, like I said, there's lots and lots of smart people out there that can figure out the next step for a lot of these things. I've done the hard work, right, in coming up with the technology in the first place. But let's look at my limitations as an individual and say, oh, should he be manufacturing everything as well, or setting up a manufacturing plant? No, right. I'm better off doing what I'm doing, right? Yeah. Running the company, coming up with new ideas. Seeing what the next steps are, working on the camouflage, right? And that keeps me busy enough that I really don't have a lot of extra time to do anything else out there too.
So yeah, a few more questions on that, really. So in terms of, obviously you've come this far, and you mentioned you've had like investors along the way that you're trying to obviously create value for. And I wonder, in terms of how is that, obviously you're in Canada where there's different methods of modes of funding you can access through the government and through like startup grants and stuff like that. I'm curious how you've been able to keep the lights on all this time without the financial backing of, you know, a big angel, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, we all, our financing has been through the shareholders and through our camouflage licenses out there.
Right.
That's it. Remember, we thought it was going to be classified, so we had to be very careful about what we could disclose. So through all that time, I couldn't approach a group, even the government for the most part, and say, we would like some help in getting this off the ground, right?
Right, right.
Because you have to disclose too much in the proposals that you put out there. We didn't go after any grants out there as well, right? And a lot of people go, well, that was foolish. And I'm like, no, we had the same issues, right? We thought a lot of it was going to be classified. And so even at the building that you and I shared, right, we had a special room that was locked off. We had the only key. Even the landlord, right, didn't have the key to get in that room for reasons of security around the material out there, right?
Yeah.
And then I had to be careful about, when I took it home, right, that I couldn't stop anywhere on my way from home, so it wasn't left alone in the vehicle where someone might be able to access it. Now, none of that matters, right?
Right.
We're well beyond that. But it did prevent us from actually going after a lot of the financing that we otherwise could have gotten. Yeah. And so now at this stage, we can take further investors, but they either have to be very close friends of a director or family, or they have to be an accredited investor, and the US and Canada have very similar regulations on that. So you have to have a net income of $200,000 for the previous 2 years and the year coming up, or a combined income with your wife or spouse of $300,000, And it can't be in the real estate that you live in. And what they are doing there, the Securities Commission is trying to prevent people from coming into a company where they don't know the directors. They don't, it's stopping people from getting swindled.
Yeah.
Right. So a person with lots of money that meets the criteria of a accredited investor knows better, right? And if they lose the money, it's not a big deal. You should have known better, right?
Yeah.
So that's why those rules are in place, right? We have to turn away lots of people that want to invest in the company. And it's like, I'm sorry, right? I don't know you, or I don't know you that well, right? Mm-hmm. Even people that have known me for a while don't meet the close friends criteria, right? So yeah, that, so we are hoping that we do get, I got to be very careful here because we're working on contracts where there's non-disclosure agreements involved.
Yeah,
But we are working with groups out there that are considering providing us that financial support to get us to the next level. Yeah.
Okay. So as we kind of come to an end here, I thought I'd ask you a few more fun questions, I guess.
Yeah.
What is something from a movie or from that is mythical that you would like to invent?
There'd be two things, right? One would be the invisibility cloak that everyone envisions, like Harry Potter, that just you wrap around yourself and you're invisible. But that right now looks to be not possible in the short term, meaning 4 or 5, 6 years.
Yeah.
The second thing would be super high speed travel through the universe, right? The problem is I know my wife, when she dreams, she can fly in her dreams. I can't because my brain goes, that's impossible. You can't fly, right? So I know that faster than light travel is likely the impossibility, but getting close to the speed of light is not. Right. So having the ability to get to the outer parts of our solar system in weeks or months versus years, which we're going to get to, that technology will come about.
Yeah.
I just wish I could see something like that in my lifetime come to a fruition where it would just change a lot about what we do and how we do it. Right. Very similar to what you're seeing with SpaceX right now, right?
Right.
It has totally changed the way we look at putting things on. If I go to YouTube almost daily, there's another launch going on at SpaceX, right?
Yeah.
And I watch them, right? Because they're fantastic to see that rocket coming right back down to that landing pad and going, how the heck did they figure that out? Right. That is amazing that it was just up hundreds of kilometers in the air and 7 minutes later, it's at a pinpoint from where it started, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much for your time today, Guy.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Your passion for what you do just comes through. And I hope that, you know, when people see this, they take their time and really, really take that in. And I what I really want to see for your company is just a future where, you know, a lot of your technology is applied not just to military, but also to potentially surprising applications, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And hopefully out of the hands of the bad guys.
Yes, that is the hope. Hope and desire still, yes.
Yeah. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you guys for joining the podcast today. If you're new around here, don't forget to subscribe down below. And obviously, I'll link details for where you can find Guy and his company. Drop us a comment down below. Thank you so much for joining this episode. So see you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wolf of Yonge Street podcast. If you derive value from this podcast, please don't forget to subscribe. I would love to hear from you as well. So please comment your thoughts down below.